100 years ago this week, preparations were underway for the opening session of the Irish Convention. It lasted from July 1917 until April 1918 and was the last attempt made to provide a unitary solution to the Irish question. The convention faced two main threats, one from Ulster Unionists who were intent on a partition solution that would keep an undetermined portion of Ulster within the Act of Union. The second threat was from Sinn Féin, who boycotted the convention at a time where they were gaining ground in key by-elections and winning converts nationwide. Now, the convention ended in abject failure, but rather than looking at it as one of the great what-ifs of Irish history, in what ways was the Irish Convention a carefully stage-managed event designed to stifle the two most popular forces on the island of Ireland, in other words, Ulster Unionism and Irish Republicanism? Well, to analyse all of this, we're joined by UCD lecturer in Irish history, Dr. Conor Mulva, to find out more.
Good morning, Conor.
Good morning and welcome. The Irish Convention, I mean, it's not something that looms large when we look back at the period.
No, certainly. And I suppose if we take this from the anniversary culture perspective, this is something that occurs in something of a lag between the great military campaigns of the 1916 Rising and the outbreak of the War of Independence. However, constitutionally, this is certainly one of the most interesting instances within the long Irish Revolution, that a bunch of people were put in a room, hothoused, and asked, solve this. Go sit together. If you say that you want to govern Ireland, here's 100 Irishmen in a room.
So who are they? I mean, how do you pick the? It's a bit like, you know, the hearings that we have at the moment about what we should do about the Shannon or the repeal of the Eighth or whatever. Mm. I mean, now we have polling to select appropriate people. What do they do then?
Yes, well, I would say that this is more Gallup representative than ballot representative. This was the idea by the British government that they could pick 101 Irish men, and they were all men, and put them in a room together, and they would be representative of the various factions of Irish life. However, within that mix, you have careful hand-picking by the government, and this is where I would argue that the Irish Convention, if we look at it in a world history perspective, occurs at a key juncture between the end of the old politics of the long 19th century and just at the dawn of the beginning of the democratic age, where nationalism dominates, going right the way from the end of the First World War into, I suppose,
but were they right? I mean, in the sense that until you got the DUP and Sinn Féin talking in Northern Ireland, the trouble would not stop.
It is a strand of thinking. I think the main thing here is you have to ask how much a group of handpicked individuals can bring along their constituencies, and how representative they are, and how much of a mandate they have to speak for those constituencies. And one of the things we have to ask here is to what extent the membership of the Irish Convention was handpicked by the British government in order to get the result they wanted. So when you're setting the agenda and you've picked the people to talk about that agenda, you're maintaining a huge amount of control with a veil of democracy over that.
But Sinn Féin boycotted it.
They did indeed, yes.
So therefore you're missing a key component.
You're missing a few key components. Two political parties actually boycotted it. Sinn Féin, which we all know because of the 1918 general election and the landslide they won in Ireland there. The other one is the All for Ireland League, largely forgotten party now, but a conglomeration of arch-clericalists under an individual called T.M. Healy, who later became Governor General of Ireland, and a marked anti-clericalist, William O'Brien, who was one of the main forces in grassroots agrarian popular politics right the way through the late 19th into the early 20th century. Additionally, the Dublin and Cork trades councils boycotted it. So key groups that I would say could be identified as alternative politics, anti-establishment politics, and democratic in terms of the trades councils were boycotting what they saw as this hand-selected, carefully stage-managed agenda set gathering of individuals in Trinity.
What solution, and we can only guess at this, mm-hmm. maybe, did Lloyd George want?
Well,
I mean, in handpicking, you have a result in mind. What did he have in mind?
I suppose the one thing we can say is that this is a last-ditch attempt to solve the Irish question in a unitary fashion. Now, many scholars would say that the partition settlement for Ireland was already a done deal, because in the summer of 1916, Ulster nationalists had conceded to the fact that an undetermined portion of Ulster would be left out of Home Rule for an undetermined period of time. So they conceded the principle of partition. That meant that Ulster Unionists were already clearly in favour of it. Now nationalists have said, OK, to save the ship, we'll float out in the life raft. So it was something of a moot point by that particular juncture.
So partition was inevitable at that point?
Historians are always reluctant about this question of inevitability, but yes.
Yeah. have been a kind of a federal solution or a canton type.
And we see this occurring in the report of the Irish Convention, which is submitted in April of 1918. Certain conventioners write, we much prefer either a Canadian or a Swiss system. Federation is something which has been knocking around the Irish question since at least 1910, going right back to the 1870s, incidentally. But it comes up again in the report of this. Let's just try and federate. Let's try and give Ulster some kind of internal control.
So in that case, there would have been a Stormont Parliament, a Dublin Parliament, and then there would be representatives sent from those two parliaments to Westminster, one presumes.
That would be one of the solutions.
Of course, it didn't happen. So the report, what did the report say?
Well, the report, first of all, I think in the spirit of modern reports that take a long time to be authored, this report is quite impressive. The convention sits for the last time sometime in late March of 1918, from memory, and by the middle of April, the report is submitted to government.
Wouldn't happen today.
It's quite incredible. The convention's chairman is an individual called Horace Plunkett. He's a very good selection, I would say, for a chairman. He's well liked by almost all sides. He's a Dubliner, but he's a Southern Unionist. So he has links into Irish Unionism, North and South. The Irish party are fairly okay with him. He's been heavily involved with the cooperative movement, people like George Russell AE, these kind of people. So he's seen as kind of an honest broker for Ireland. And he gets together this report. However, when you read through this very long, it's 176 pages of a report produced in a month, so very impressive. Yeah. But really, it is just a compilation of submissions, minority reports, majority reports, appendices, etc.
Okay. Now, had at that stage Southern Unionism given up the ghost?
Well, I would say this is the last gasp of Southern Unionism. A pivotal figure here is Lord Middleton, who becomes, maybe through his own desire rather than through any election, the representative of Southern Unionism at this convention. And he becomes key to, I suppose, progressing a scheme for the convention at large. He enters into, I suppose, convivial talks with John Redmond, who's the leader of the Home Rule Party. He realises quite quickly the gulf between himself and the Ulster Unionists. And this is where we see, I suppose, a flourishing of an Irish identity that becomes lost in the later Irish Revolution, in the War of Independence. And that is a combined, let's say, Unionist, Nationalist, Protestant, Catholic, civic form of Irish identity that people like John Redmond, Lord Middleton, hope will be forged in the trenches, that orange and green will bleed as red and a new Irish nation will spring from the ashes. And in a constitutional way, this is the last gasp of that kind of vision.
It wasn't all work and no play.
Yes, and this is I think, if we look at any of these histories of consensus building, we need to look at how consensus is manufactured. And again, this is where I stress that the overall architecture of the convention was designed by the British government, the agenda was set, but also the sittings of the convention. So in September of 1917, the Irish Convention took tours of Belfast, Dublin and Cork. Part of these were deliberately engineered to include an active and varied social life. And this is one of the few ways that women were involved in the convention, not the ordinary woman who would be, if she was over 30, enfranchised in 1918, but society women who held grand parties. And the idea here was most of the conventioners weren't involved in rolling up their sleeves and the heavy lifting. Subcommittees, committee of nine, a grand committee of 20, they made the big decisions at the convention. So the other 80 or so members who were on nominally important commissions on pay and these kind of things, they then went to these parties and consensus was built between unionists and nationalists who otherwise wouldn't have talked to each other.
Now, they stopped in March of 1918. They reported in April of 1918.
Yes.
But had they got a time limit and did they adhere to it, or did the convention just run out of steam?
In some ways, the convention fizzles out. One of its main champions is John Redmond. And Redmond actually fails to bring his own closest supporters through the Christmas recess. Individuals like the Catholic Bishop of Raphoe, Patrick O'Donnell, and the MP for West Belfast, Joseph Devlin, they come to Redmond in January of 1918 and say, look, we're actually no longer behind this. This is going in directions you're too close to Middleton and we're not behind the convention. So they become a little bit lukewarm about the idea of the convention. Redmond dies on the 6th of March 1918, and in some senses the convention dies with him. Key members have already resigned from the convention. And if we just take one view of the convention, written in 1923, William O'Brien, that guy I mentioned earlier of the All for Ireland League, said, the convention was not framed for Ireland at all. It was only a means of conquering America's his last hesitation about entering actively into the war. For the main achievement of the Irish Convention will be remembered that it was to go on talking and elaborately keep this up for 8 months until President Wilson made up his mind that he would involve himself in the invasion of Europe. And the assembly of talkers was then quietly bundled out of notice once this was
done. So there was a bigger agenda.
Well, that's what William O'Brien said.
Interesting, isn't it? And of course, the war being the background to all of this, and the Somme, and the many, many millions who died.
Absolutely. Well, we just have to remember how much time Lloyd George has invested in the Irish question from 1912 up to when he presided over negotiations in 1916. At this point, he just said to the Irish, you get on with it. If you can solve Ireland, get over it.
Many people have forgotten this. You haven't. And also there are a couple of commemorative events.
Just to plug some colleagues in other universities that are working on this at the moment. My colleague Brian Hughes in Maynooth University is organising a conference on Southern Irish loyalism and context. That will be held in Maynooth on the 21st and 22nd of July, so later this week. And next week in Trinity College Dublin, a symposium will be held on the 25th and 26th of July to mark the centenary of the opening of the Irish Convention.
Dr. Conamova, thank you very much.